in any way that imparted humor. Bosch nodded and stepped outside behind Edgar. Chapter 25. Bosch walked up to the museum ticket window and told the woman sitting behind it his name and that he had an appointment with Dr. William Gallagher in the anthropology lab. She picked up a phone and made a call. A few minutes later, she rapped on the glass with her wedding band until it drew the attention of a nearby security guard. He came over and the woman instructed him to escort Bosch to the lab. He did not have to pay the admission. The guard said nothing as they walked through the dimly lit museum, past the mammoth display and the wall of wolf skulls. Bosch had never been inside the museum, though he had gone to the La Brea tar pits often on field trips when he was a child. The museum was built after that to house and display all of the finds that bubbled up out of the earth and the tar pits. When Bosch had called Gallagher's cell phone after receiving the medical records on Arthur Delacroix, the anthropologist said he was already working on another case and couldn't get downtown to the medical examiner's office until the next day. Bosch had said he couldn't wait. Gallagher said he did have copies of the x-rays and photographs from the Wonderland case with him. If Bosch could come to him, he could make the comparisons and give an unofficial response. Bosch took the compromise and headed to the tar pits while Edgar remained at Hollywood Division working the computer to see if he could locate Arthur and Sheila Delacroix's mother as well as run down Arthur's friend, Johnny Stokes. Now, Bosch was curious as to what the new case was that Gallagher was working. The tar pits were an ancient black hole where animals had gone to their death for centuries. In a grim chain reaction, animals caught in the miasma became prey for other animals, who in turn were mired and slowly pulled down. In some form of natural equilibrium, the bones now came back up out of the blackness and were collected for study by modern man. All of this took place right next to one of the busiest streets in Los Angeles, a constant reminder of the crushing passage of time. Bosch was led through two doors and into the crowded lab where the bones were identified, classified, dated, and cleaned. There appeared to be boxes of bones everywhere on every flat surface. A half dozen people in white lab coats worked at stations cleaning and examining the bones. Gallagher was the only one not in a lab coat. He had on another Hawaiian shirt, this one with parrots on it, and was working at a table in the far corner. As Bosch approached, he saw there were two wooden bone boxes on the work table in front of him. In one of the boxes was a skull. "Detective Bosch, how are you?"
"Doing okay."
"What's this?"
"This, as I'm sure you can tell, is a human skull. It and some other human bones were collected 2 days ago from asphalt that was actually excavated 30 years ago to make room for this museum. They've asked me to take a look before they make the announcement."
"I don't understand. Is it old or from 30 years ago?"
"Oh, it's quite old. It was carbon dated to 9,000 years ago, actually."
Bosch nodded. The skull and the bones in the other box looked like mahogany.
"Take a look," Gallagher said, and he lifted the skull out of the box.
He turned it so that the rear of the skull faced Bosch. He moved his finger in a circle around a star fracture near the top of the skull.
"Look familiar?"
"Blunt force fracture?"
"Exactly. Much like your case. Just goes to show you."
He gently replaced the skull in the wooden box.
"Show me what?" "Things don't change that much. This woman, at least we think it was a woman, was murdered 9,000 years ago, her body probably thrown into the tar pit as a means of covering the crime. Human nature. It doesn't change."
Bosch stared at the skull.
"She's not the first."
Bosch looked up at Gallagher.
"In 1914, the bones, a more complete skeleton, actually, of another woman were found in the tar. She had the same star fracture in the same spot on her skull. Her bones were carbon dated as 9,000 years old. Same time frame as her."
He nodded to the skull in the box. So what are you saying, Doc? That there was a serial killer here 9,000 years ago?
It's impossible to know that, Detective Bosch. All we have are the bones.
Bosch looked down at the skull again. He thought about what Julia Brasher had said about his job, about his taking evil out of the world. What she didn't know was a truth he had known for too long, that true evil could never be taken out of the world. At best, he was wading into the dark waters of the abyss with two leaking buckets in his hands.
But you have other things on your mind, don't you? Gallagher said, interrupting Bosch's thoughts. Do you have the hospital records?
Bosch brought his briefcase up onto the work table and opened it. He handed Gallagher a file. Then, from his pocket, he pulled the stack of photos he and Edgar had borrowed from Sheila Delacroix.
I don't know if these help, he said, but this is the kid.
Gallagher picked up the photos. He went through them quickly, stopping at the posed close-up of Arthur Delacroix in a jacket and tie. He went over to a chair where a backpack was slung over the armrest. He pulled out his own file and came back to the work table. He opened the file and took out an 8x10 photo of the skull from Wonderland Avenue. For a long moment he held the photos of Arthur Delacroix and the skull side by side and studied them. Finally he said, "The malar and superciliary ridge formation look similar."
"I'm not an anthropologist, Doc."
Gallagher put the photos down on the table. He then explained by running his finger across the left eyebrow of the boy and then down around the outside of his eye.
"The brow ridge and the exterior orbit," he said. "It's wider than usual on the recovered specimen. Looking at this photo of the boy, we see his facial structure is in line with what we see here."
Bosch nodded.
"Let's look at the X-rays," Gallagher said. "There's a box back here."
Gallagher gathered the files and led Bosch to another work table, where there was a light box built into the surface. He opened the hospital file, picked up the X-rays, and began reading the patient history report.
Bosch had already read the document.
The hospital reported that the boy was brought into the emergency room at 5:40 p.m. on February 11, 1980, by his father, who said he was found in a dazed and unresponsive state following a fall from a skateboard in which he struck his head. Neurosurgery was performed in order to relieve pressure inside the skull caused by swelling of the brain. The boy remained in the hospital under observation for 10 days and was then released to his father. 2 weeks later, he was readmitted for follow-up surgery to remove the clips that had been used to hold his skull together following the neurosurgery. There was no report anywhere in the file of the boy complaining about being mistreated by his father or anyone else. While recovering from the initial surgery, he was routinely interviewed by an on-site social worker. Her report was less than half a page. It reported that the boy said he had hurt himself while skateboarding. There was no follow-up questioning or referral to juvenile authorities or the police. Gallagher shook his head while he finished his scan of the document.
"What is it?" Bosch asked.
"It's nothing." "And that's the problem. No investigation. They took the boy at his word. His father was probably sitting right there in the room with him when he was interviewed. You know how hard it would have been for him to tell the truth. So they just patched him up and sent him right back to the person who was hurting him."
"Hey, Doc, you're getting a little bit ahead of us. Let's get the ID if it's there, and then we'll figure out who was hurting the kid."
"Fine. It's your case. It's just that I've seen this 100 times.
Gallagher dropped the reports and picked up the X-rays. Bosch watched him with a bemused smile on his face. It seemed that Gallagher was annoyed because Bosch had not jumped to the same conclusions he had with the same speed he had. Gallagher put 2 X-rays down on the light box. He then went to his own file and brought out X-rays he had taken of the Wonderland skull. He flipped the box's light on and 3 X-rays glowed before them. Gallagher pointed to the X-ray he had taken from his own file.
This is a radiological X-ray I took to look inside the bone of the skull. But we can use it here for comparison purposes. Tomorrow, when I get back to the medical examiner's office, I will use the skull itself.
Gullaher leaned over the light box and reached for a small glass eyepiece that was stored on a nearby shelf. He held one end to his eye and pressed the other against one of the X-rays. After a few moments, he moved to one of the hospital X-rays and pressed the eyepiece to the same location on the skull. He went back and forth numerous times, making comparison after comparison. When he was finished, Gullaher straightened up, leaned back against the next work table, and folded his arms.
Queen of Angels was a government-subsidized hospital. Money was always tight. They should have taken more than two pictures of this kid's head. If they had, they might have seen some of his other injuries.
Okay, but they didn't.
Yeah, they didn't. But based on what they did do and what we've got here, I was able to make several comparison points on the roundel, the fracture pattern, and along the squamous suture. There is no doubt in my mind.
He gestured toward the X-rays still glowing on the light box.
Meet Arthur Delacroix.
Bosch nodded. Okay.
Gullaher stepped over to the light box and started collecting the X-rays.
How sure are you?
Like I said, there's no doubt. I'll look at the skull tomorrow when I'm downtown, but I can tell you now, it's him. It's a match.
So, if we get somebody and go into court with it, there aren't going to be any surprises, right?
Gullaher looked at Bosch.
No surprises. These findings can't be challenged. As you know, the challenge lies in the interpretation of the injuries. I look at this boy and see something horribly, horribly wrong, and I will testify to that, gladly. But then, you have these official records.
He gestured dismissively to the open file of hospital records.
They say skateboard. That's where the fight will be.
Bosch nodded.
Gullaher put the two X-rays back into the file and closed it.
Bosch put it back in his briefcase.
Well, Doctor, thanks for taking the time to see me here. I think, Detective Bosch.
Yes.
The other day you seemed very uncomfortable when I mentioned the necessity of faith in what we do. Basically, you changed the subject.
Not really a subject I feel comfortable talking about.
I would think that in your line of work it would be paramount to have a healthy spirituality.
I don't know.
My partner likes blaming aliens from outer space for everything that's wrong.
I guess that's healthy, too.
You're avoiding the question.
Bosch grew annoyed, and the feeling quickly slipped toward anger.
What is the question, Doc? Why do you care so much about me and what I believe or don't believe?
Because it is important to me. I study bones, the framework of life. And I have come to believe that there is something more than blood and tissue and bone. There is something else that holds us together. I have something inside that you'll never see on any X-ray that holds me together and keeps me going. And so when I meet someone who carries a void in the place where I carry my faith, I get scared for him.
Bosch looked at him for a long moment.
You're wrong about me.
I have faith, and I have a mission.
Call it blue religion. Call it whatever you like. It's the belief that this won't just go by. That those bones came out of the ground for a reason. That they came out of the ground for me to find and for me to do something about. And that's what holds me together and keeps me going. And it won't show up on any X-ray, either. Okay?
He stared at Gullaher, waiting for a reply. But the anthropologist said nothing.
I gotta go, Doctor, Bosch finally said. Thanks for your help. You've made things very clear for me.
He left him there, surrounded by the dark bones the city had been built on.
Chapter 26.
Edgar was not at his spot at the homicide table when Bosch got back to the squad room.
Harry?
Bosch looked up and saw Lieutenant Billets standing in the doorway to her office. Through the glass window, Bosch could see Edgar in there sitting in front of her desk. Bosch put his briefcase down and headed over.
"What's up?" he said as he entered the office.
"No, that's my question," Billets said as she closed the door.
"Do we have an ID?"
She went around behind her desk and sat down as Bosch took the seat next to Edgar.
"Yes, we have an ID. Arthur Delacroix disappeared May 4th, 1980.
"The ME is sure of this?"
"Their bone guy says there's no doubt."
"How close are we on time of death?"
"Pretty close.
The bone guy said before we knew anything that the fatal impact to the skull came about 3 months after the kid had the earlier skull fracture in surgery. We got the records on that surgery today.
February 11, 1980, at Queen of Angels. You add 3 months and we're almost right on the button.
Arthur Delacroix disappeared May 4th, according to his sister. The point is, Arthur Delacroix was dead 4 years before Nicholas Trent moved into that neighborhood. I think that puts him in the clear.
Billets reluctantly nodded.
"I've had Irving's office and media relations on my ass all day about this," she said. "They're not going to like it when I call them back with this."
"That's too bad," Bosch said.
"That's the way the case shakes out."
"Okay, so Trent wasn't in the neighborhood in 1980. Do we have anything yet on where he was?"
Bosch blew out his breath and shook his head.
"You're not going to let this go, are you? We need to concentrate on the kid."
"I'm not letting go because they're not. Irving called me himself this morning. He was very clear without having to say the words. If it turns out an innocent man killed himself because a cop leaked information to the media that held him up to public ridicule, then it's one more black eye for the department. Haven't we had enough humiliation in the last 10 years?
Bosch smiled without a hint of humor.
"You sound just like him, Lieutenant.
That's really good."
It was the wrong thing to say. He could see that it hurt her.
"Yeah, well, maybe I sound like him because I agree with him for once. This department has had nothing but scandal after scandal. Like most of the decent cops around here, I for one am sick of it."
"Good. So am I. But the solution is not to bend things to fit our needs. This is a homicide case."
"I know that, Harry. I'm not saying bend anything. I'm saying we have to be sure."
"We're sure. I'm sure." They were silent for a long moment, everyone's eyes avoiding the others.
"What about kids?" Edgar finally asked.
Bosch sneered. "Irving won't do a thing to kids," he said. "He knows it'll make him look even worse if he touches her. Besides, she's probably the best cop they got down there on the third floor."
"You're always so sure, Harry," Billet said. "It must be nice."
"Well, I'm sure about this." He stood up.
"And I'd like to get back to it. We've got stuff happening."
"I know all about it. Jerry was just telling me.
But sit down and let's get back to this for 1 minute, okay?"
Bosch sat back down.
"I can't just talk to Irving the way I let you talk to me," Billet said. "This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to update him on the ID and everything else. I'm going to say you are pursuing the case as is. I will then invite him to assign IAD to the background investigation of Trent. In other words, if he remains unconvinced by the circumstances of the ID, then he can have IAD or whoever he can find run the background on Trent to see where he was in 1980.
Bosch just looked at her, giving no indication of approval or disapproval of her plan.
"Can we go now?"
"Yes, you can go."
When they got back to the homicide table and sat down, Edgar asked Bosch why he hadn't mentioned the theory that maybe Trent moved into the neighborhood because he knew the bones were up on the hillside.
"Because your sick fuck theory is too far-fetched to go beyond this table for the time being. If that gets to Irving, next thing you know it's in a press release and is the official line. Now, did you get anything on the box or not?"
"Yeah, I got stuff."
"What?"
"First of all,
I confirm Samuel Delacroix's address at the Manchester Trailer Park. So he's there when we want to go see him. In the last 10 years, he's had 2 DUIs. He drives on a restricted license at the moment. I also ran his social and came up with a hit. He works for the city.
Bosch's face showed his surprise.
Doing what?
He works part-time at a driving range at the municipal golf course right next to the trailer park.
I made a call to Parks and Recs, discreetly.
Delacroix drives the cart that collects all the balls, you know, out on the range. The guy everybody tries to hit when he's out there.
I guess he comes over from the trailer park and does it a couple times a day.
Okay.
Next. Christine Dorset Delacroix, the name of the mother on Sheila's birth certificate. I ran her social and got her now listed as Christine Dorset Waters. Address is in Palm Springs. Must have gone there to reinvent herself. New name, new life, whatever.
Bosch nodded.
You pulled the divorce?
Got it.
She filed on Samuel Delacroix in 73. The boy would have been about 5 at the time. Cited mental and physical abuse. Details of what that abuse consisted of were not included. It never went to trial, so the details never came out.
He didn't contest it?
It looks like a deal was made. He got custody of the 2 kids and didn't contest. Nice and clean. The file's about 12 pages thick. I've seen some that are 12 inches. My own, for example.
If Arthur was 5, some of those injuries predate that, according to the anthropologist.
Edgar shook his head.
The extract says the marriage had ended 3 years prior and they were living separately, so it looks like she split when the boy was about 2, like Sheila said.
Harry, you usually don't refer to the Vic by name.
Yeah, so?
Just point it out.
Thank you. Anything else in the file?
That's about it. I got copies if you want it.
Okay, what about the skateboard friend?
Got him too.
Still alive, still local.
But there's a problem. I ran all the usual data banks and came up with 3 John Stokes in L.A. that fall into the right age range. 2 are in the Valley, both clean. The 3rd's a player. Multiple arrests for petty theft, auto theft, burglary, and possession going back to a full juvie jacket. 5 years ago, he finally ran out of second chances and got sent to Corcoran to iron out a nickel. Did 2.5 to parole.
You talked to his agent? Is Stokes still on the line?
Talked to his agent, yes. No, Stokes isn't on the hook. He cleared parole 2 months ago.
The agent doesn't know where he is.
Damn. Yeah, but I got him to pull a look at the client bio. It has Stokes growing up mostly in mid-Wilshire. In and out of foster homes, in and out of trouble. He's got to be our guy.
The agent think he's still in L.A.?
Yeah, he thinks so.
We just got to find him.
I already had patrol go by his last known. He moved out of there as soon as he cleared parole.
So he's in the wind. Beautiful.
Edgar nodded.
We have to put him on the box, Bosch said.
Start with, did it, Edgar said. I also typed up a roll call notice and gave it to Mankiewicz a while ago. He promised to get it read at all calls. I'm having a batch of visor photos made, too.
Good.
Bosch was impressed.
Getting photos of Stokes to clip to the sun visors of every patrol car was the sort of extra step Edgar usually didn't bother to make.
We'll get him, Harry. I'm not sure what good he'll do us, but we'll get him.
He could be a key witness.
If Arthur,
I mean the Vic, ever told him his father was beating him, then we've got something.
Bosch looked at his watch. It was almost 2. He wanted to keep things moving, keep the investigation focused and urgent. For him, the most difficult time was waiting. Whether it was for lab results or other cops to make moves, it was always when he became most agitated.
What do you have going tonight? He asked Edgar.
Tonight? Nothing much.
You got your kid tonight?
No, Thursdays. Why?
I'm thinking about going out to the Springs.
Now?
Yeah.
Talk to the ex-wife.
He saw Edgar check his watch.
He knew that even if they left that moment, they still wouldn't get back until late.
It's all right. I can go by myself. Just give me the address.
Nah, I'm going with you.
You sure?
You don't have to.
I just don't like waiting around for something to happen, you know?
Yeah, Harry, I know.
Edgar stood up and took his jacket off the back of his chair.
Then I'll go tell Bullets, Bosch said.
Chapter 27 They were more than halfway across the desert to Palm Springs before either one of them spoke.
Harry, Edgar said.
You're not talking.
I know, Bosch said.
The one thing they had always had as partners was the ability to share long silences. Whenever Edgar felt the need to break the silence, Bosch knew there was something on his mind he wanted to talk about.
What is it, J. Edgar?
Nothing.
The case?
No, man, nothing. I'm cool.
All right, then.
They were passing a windmill farm. The air was dead. None of the blades were turning.
Did your parents stay together? Bosch asked.
Yeah, all the way, Edgar said.
Then he laughed.
I think they wish sometimes they didn't, but yeah, they stuck it out. That's how it goes, I guess. The strong survive.
Bosch nodded. They were both divorced, but rarely talked about their failed marriages.
Harry, I heard about you and the boot.
It's getting around.
Bosch nodded. This is what Edgar had wanted to bring up. Rookies in the department were often called boots. The origin of the term was obscure. One school of thought was that it referred to boot camp. Another, that it was a sarcastic reference to rookies being the new boots of the fascist empire.
All I'm saying, man, is be careful with that. You got rank on her, okay?
Yeah, I know. I'll figure something out.
From what I hear and have seen, she's worth the risk. But you still gotta be careful.
Bosch didn't say anything. After a few minutes, they passed a road sign that said Palm Springs was coming up in 9 miles. It was nearing dusk. Bosch was hoping to knock on the door where Christine Waters lived before it got dark.
Harry, you gonna take the lead on this when we get there?
Yeah, I'll take it.
You can be the indignant one.
That will be easy.
Once they crossed the city boundary into Palm Springs, they picked up a map at a gas station and made their way through the town until they found Frank Sinatra Boulevard and took it up toward the mountains. Bosch pulled the car up to the gatehouse of a place called Mountain Gate Estates. Their map showed the street Christine Waters lived on was within Mountain Gate. A uniformed rent-a-cop stepped out of the gatehouse, eyeing the slick back they were in and smiling.
You guys are a little ways off the beat, he said.
Bosch nodded and tried to give a pleasant smile, but it only made him look like he had something sour in his mouth.
Something like that, he said.
What's up?
We're going to talk to Christine Waters, 312 Deepwaters Drive.
Mrs. Waters know you're coming?
Not unless she's a psychic, or you tell her.
That's my job. Hold on a second.
He returned to the gatehouse, and Bosch saw him pick up a phone.
Looks like Christine Delacroix seriously traded up, Edgar said.
He was looking through the windshield at some of the homes that were visible from their position. They were all huge, with manicured lawns big enough to play touch football on. The guard came out, put both hands on the windowsill of the car, and leaned down to look in at Bosch.
She wants to know what it's about.
Tell her we'll discuss it with her at her house, privately.
Tell her we have a court order.
The guard shrugged his shoulders in a have-it-your-way gesture and went back inside. Bosch watched him speaking on the phone for a few more moments. After he hung up, the gate started to open slowly. The guard stood in the open doorway and waved them in, but not without the last word.
You know, that tough guy stuff probably works real well for you in L.A. Out here in the desert, it's just...
Bosch didn't hear the rest. He drove through the gate while putting the window up. They found Deepwaters Drive at the far extreme of the development. The homes here looked to be a couple $1,000,000 more opulent than those built near the entrance to Mountain Gate.
Who would name a street in the desert Deep Waters Drive? Edgar mused.
Maybe somebody named Waters.
It dawned on Edgar then.
Damn. You think?
Then she really has traded up. The address Edgar came up with for Christine Waters corresponded with a mansion of contemporary Spanish design that sat at the end of a cul-de-sac at the terminus of Mountain Gate Estates. It was most definitely the development's premier lot. The house was positioned on a promontory that afforded it a view of all the other homes in the development, as well as a sweeping view of the golf course that surrounded it. The property had its own gated drive, but the gate was open. Bosch wondered if it always stood open or had been open for them.
This is going to be interesting, Edgar said as they pulled into a parking circle made of interlocking paving stones.
Just remember, Bosch said. People can change their addresses, but they can't change who they are.
Right. Homicide 101.
They got out and walked under the portico that led to the double-wide front door. It was opened before they got to it by a woman in a black and white maid's uniform. In a thick Spanish accent, the woman told them that Mrs. Waters was waiting in the living room. The living room was the size and had the feel of a small cathedral, with a 25-foot ceiling with exposed roof beams. High on the wall facing the east were three large stained glass windows, a triptych depicting a sunrise, a garden, and a moonrise. The opposite wall had six side-by-side sliding doors with a view of a golf course putting green. The room had two distinct groupings of furniture, as if to accommodate two separate gatherings at the same time. Sitting in the middle of a cream-colored couch in the first grouping was a woman with blonde hair and a tight face. Her pale blue eyes followed the men as they entered and took in the size of the room.
Mrs. Waters, Bosch said. I'm Detective Bosch, and this is Detective Edgar. We're from the Los Angeles Police Department.
He held out his hand, and she took it, but didn't shake it. She just held it for a moment, and then moved on to Edgar's outstretched hand. Bosch knew from the birth certificate that she was 56 years old, but she looked close to a decade younger, her smooth tan face a testament to the wonders of modern medical science.
Please have a seat, she said. I can't tell you how embarrassed I am to have that car sitting in front of my house. I guess discretion is not the better part of valor when it comes to the LAPD.
Bosch smiled.
Well, Mrs. Waters, we're kind of embarrassed about it, too, but that's what the bosses tell us to drive. So that's what we drive.
What is this about? The guard at the gate said you have a court order. May I see it?
Bosch sat down on a couch directly opposite her and across a black coffee table with gold designs inlaid on it.
He must have misunderstood me, he said. I told him we could get a court order if you refused to see us.
I'm sure he did, she replied,
the tone of her voice letting them know she didn't believe Bosch at all.
What do you want to see me about?
We need to ask you about your husband.
My husband has been dead for 5 years. Besides that, he rarely went to Los Angeles. What could he possibly?
Your first husband, Mrs. Waters. Samuel Delacroix. We need to talk to you about your children as well.
Bosch saw weariness immediately enter her eyes.
I haven't seen or spoken to them in years.
Almost 30 years.
You mean since you went out for medicine for the boy and forgot to come back home? Edgar asked.
The woman looked at him as though he had slapped her.
Bosch had hoped Edgar was going to use a little more finesse when he acted indignant with her.
Who told you that?
Mrs. Waters, Bosch said. I want to ask questions first, and then we can get to yours.
I don't understand this. How did you find me? What are you doing? Why are you here?
Her voice rose with emotion from question to question. A life she had put aside 30 years before was suddenly intruding into the carefully ordered life she now had.
We're homicide investigators, ma'am. We're working on a case that may involve your husband.
He's not my husband.
I divorced him 25 years ago, at least.
This is crazy. You coming here to ask about a man I don't even know anymore, that I didn't even know was still alive. I think you should leave. I want you to leave.
She stood up and extended her hand in the direction they had come in. Bosch glanced at Edgar, and then back at the woman. Her anger had turned the tan on her sculptured face uneven. There were blotches beginning to form, the tale of plastic surgery.
Mrs. Waters, sit down, Bosch said sternly. Please, try to relax.
Relax? Do you know who I am? My husband built this place. The houses, the golf course, everything. You can't just come in here like this. I could pick up the phone and have the chief of police on the line in two.
Your son is dead, lady, Edgar snapped.
The one you left behind 30 years ago. So sit down and let us ask you our questions.
She dropped back onto the couch as if her feet had been kicked out from beneath her. Her mouth opened and then closed. Her eyes were no longer on them. They were on some distant memory.
Arthur.
That's right, Edgar said. Arthur. Glad you at least remember it.
They watched her in silence for a few moments. All the years and all the distance wasn't enough. She was hurt by the news. Hurt bad. Bosch had seen it before. The past had a way of coming back up out of the ground. Always right below your feet. Bosch took his notebook out of his pocket and opened it to a blank page. He wrote "Cool It" on it and handed the notebook to Edgar.
Jerry, why don't you take some notes?
I think Mrs. Waters wants to cooperate with us. His speaking drew Christine Waters out of her blue reverie. She looked at Bosch.
What happened? Was it Sam?
We don't know. That's why we're here. Arthur has been dead a long time. His remains were found just last week. She slowly brought one of her hands to her mouth in a fist. She lightly started bumping it against her lips.
How long?
He had been buried for 20 years. It was a call from your daughter that helped us identify him.
Sheila.
It was as if she had not spoken the name in so long she had to try it out to see if it still worked. Mrs. Waters, Arthur disappeared in 1980. Did you know about that? She shook her head.
I was gone. I left almost 10 years before that.
And you had no contact with your family at all?
I thought...
She didn't finish. Bosch waited. Mrs. Waters?
I couldn't take them with me. I was young and couldn't handle... the responsibility. I ran away, I admit that. I ran away. I thought that it would be best for them to not hear from me, to not even know about me.
Bosch nodded in a way he hoped conveyed that he understood and agreed with her thinking at the time. It didn't matter that he did not. It didn't matter that his own mother had faced the same hardship of having a child too soon and under difficult circumstances, but had clung to and protected him with a fierceness that inspired his life.
You wrote them letters before you left?
Your children, I mean.
How did you know that?
Sheila told us.
What did you say in the letter to Arthur? I just told him I loved him, and I'd always think about him. But I couldn't be with him. I can't really remember everything I said. Is it important?
Bosch shrugged his shoulders. I don't know. Your son had a letter with him. It might have been the one from you. It's deteriorated. We probably won't ever know. In the divorce petition you filed a few years after leaving home, you cited physical abuse as a cause of action. I need you to tell us about that.
What was the physical abuse?
She shook her head again, this time in a dismissive way, as if the question was annoying or stupid.
What do you think? Sam liked to bat me around. He'd get drunk, and it was like walking on eggshells. Anything could set him off. The baby crying, Sheila talking too loud. And I was always the target.
He would hit you?
Yes, he would hit me. He'd become a monster. It was one of the reasons I had to leave.
But you left the kids with the monster, Edgar said. This time she didn't react as if struck. She fixed her pale eyes on Edgar with a deathly look that made Edgar turn his indignant eyes away. She spoke very calmly to him.
Who are you to judge anyone?
I had to survive, and I could not take them with me. If I had tried, none of us would have survived.
I'm sure they understood that, Edgar said.
The woman stood up again.
I don't think I'm going to talk to you anymore. I'm sure you can find your way out.
She headed toward the arched doorway at the far end of the room.
Mrs. Waters, Bosch said, if you don't talk to us now, we will go get that court order.
Fine, she said without looking back. Do it. I'll have one of my attorneys handle it.
And it will become public record at the courthouse in town.
It was a gamble, but Bosch thought it might stop her. He guessed that her life in Palm Springs was built squarely atop her secrets, and that she wouldn't want anybody going down into the basement. The social gossips might, like Edgar, have a hard time viewing her actions and motives the way she did. Deep inside, she had had a hard time herself, even after so many years. She stopped under the archway, composed herself, and came back to the couch. Looking at Bosch, she said,
I will only talk to you.
I want him to leave.
Bosch shook his head. He's my partner. It's our case. He stays, Mrs. Waters.
I will still answer questions from you only.
Fine. Please, sit down.
She did so, this time sitting on the side of the couch farthest from Edgar and closest to Bosch.
I know you want to help us find your son's killer. We'll try to be as fast as we can here.
She nodded once. Just tell us about your ex-husband.
The whole sordid story? She asked rhetorically. I'll give you the short version. I met him in an acting class. I was 18. He was 7 years older but had already done some film work, and to top it off was very, very handsome. You could say I quickly fell under his spell, and I was pregnant before I was 19.
Bosch checked Edgar to see if he was writing any of this down. Edgar caught the look and started writing.
We got married and Sheila was born. I didn't pursue a career. I have to admit I wasn't that dedicated. Acting just seemed like something to do at the time. I had the looks, but soon I found out every girl in Hollywood had the looks. I was happy to stay at home.
How did your husband do at it?
At first, very well. He got a recurring role on First Infantry. Did you ever watch it?
Bosch nodded. It was a World War II television drama that ran in the mid to late 60s until public sentiment over the Vietnam War and war in general led to declining ratings, and it was canceled. The show followed an army platoon as it moved behind German lines each week. Bosch had liked the show as a kid and always tried to watch it, whether he was in a foster home or the youth hall.
Sam was one of the Germans. His blonde hair and Aryan looks. He was on it the last 2 years, right up until I got pregnant with Arthur.
She let some silence punctuate that.
Then the show got canceled because of that stupid war in Vietnam. It got canceled and Sam had trouble finding work. He was typecast as this German. He really started drinking then. And hitting me. He'd spend his days going to casting calls and getting nothing. He'd then spend his nights drinking and being angry at me.
Why you?
Because I was the one who had gotten pregnant. First with Sheila and then with Arthur. Neither was planned and it all added up to too much pressure on him. He took it out on whoever was close.
He assaulted you?
Assaulted?
It sounds so clinical.
But yes, he assaulted me. Many times.
Did you ever see him strike the children?
It was the key question they had come to ask. Everything else was window dressing.
Not specifically, she said. When I was carrying Arthur, he hit me once, in the stomach. It broke my water. I went into labor about 6 weeks before my due date. Arthur didn't even weigh 5 pounds when he was born.
Bosch waited. She was talking in a way that hinted she would say more as long as he gave her the space. He looked out through the sliding door behind her at the golf course. There was a deep sand trap guarding a putting green. A man in a red shirt and plaid pants was in the trap, flailing with a club at an unseen ball. Sprays of sand were flying up out of the trap onto the green, but no ball. In the distance, three other golfers were getting out of two carts parked on the other side of the green. The lip of the sand trap shielded them from view of the man in the red shirt. As Bosch watched, the man checked up and down the fairway for witnesses, then reached down and grabbed his ball. He threw it up onto the green, giving it the nice arc of a perfectly hit shot. He then climbed out of the trap, holding his club with both hands still locked in their grip, a posture that suggested he had just hit the ball. Finally, Christine Waters began to talk again, and Bosch looked back at her.
Arthur only weighed 5 pounds when he was born. He was small right up through that first year and very sickly. We never talked about it, but I think we both knew that what Sam had done had hurt that boy. He just wasn't right.
Aside from that incident when he struck you, you never saw him strike Arthur or Sheila?
He might have spanked Sheila. I don't really remember. He never hit the children. I mean, he had me there to hit.
Bosch nodded. The unspoken conclusion being that once she was gone, who knows who became the target. Bosch thought of the bones laid out on the autopsy table and all the injuries Dr. Gallagher had catalogued.
Is Sam under arrest?
Bosch looked at her. No, we're in the fact-finding stage here. The indication from your son's remains is that there is a history of chronic physical abuse. We're just trying to figure things out.
And Sheila?
Was she? We haven't specifically asked her.
We will.
Mrs. Waters, when you were struck by your husband, was it always with his hand?
Sometimes he would hit me with things.
A shoe once, I remember. He held me on the floor and hit me with it.
And once he threw his briefcase at me. It hit me in the side.
She shook her head.
What?
Nothing.
Just that briefcase. He carried it with him to all his auditions, like he was so important and had so much going on. And all he ever had in it were a few headshots and a flask.
Bitterness burned in her voice, even after so many years. Did you ever go to a hospital or an emergency room? Is there any physical record of the abuse?
She shook her head. He never hurt me enough that I had to go. Except when I had Arthur, and then I lied. I said I fell and my water broke. You see, Detective, it wasn't something I wanted the world to know about.
Bosch nodded. When you left, was that planned? Or did you just go? She didn't answer for a long moment as she watched the memory first on her inside screen.
I wrote the letters to my children long before I left. I carried them in my purse and waited for the right time. On the night I left, I put them under their pillows and left with my purse and only the clothes I was wearing. And my car that my father had given us when we got married. That was it. I'd had enough. I told him we needed medicine for Arthur. He had been drinking. He told me to go out and get it.
And you never went back?
Never. About a year later, before I came out to the Springs, I drove by the house at night. Saw the lights on. I didn't stop.
Bosch nodded. He couldn't think of anything else to ask. While the woman's memory of that early time in her life was good, what she was remembering wasn't going to help make a case against her ex-husband for a murder committed 10 years after she had last seen him. Maybe Bosch had known that all along, that she wouldn't be a vital part of the case. Maybe he had just wanted to take the measure of a woman who had abandoned her children, leaving them with a man she believed was a monster.
What does she look like?
Vash was momentarily taken aback by her question.
My daughter.
She's blonde, like you. A little taller, heavier. No children, not married.
When will Arthur be buried?
I don't know. You would have to call the medical examiner's office. Or you could probably check with Sheila to see if... He stopped. He couldn't get involved in mending the 30-year gaps in people's lives. I think we're finished here, Mrs. Waters. We appreciate your cooperation. Definitely, Edgar said, the sarcasm in his tone making its mark.
You came all this way to ask so few questions.
I think that's because you have so few answers, Edgar said. They walked to the door, and she followed a few paces behind. Outside, under the portico, Bosch looked back at the woman standing in the open doorway. They held each other's eyes for a moment. He tried to think of something to say, but he had nothing for her. She closed the door. Chapter 28. They pulled into the station lot shortly before 11. It had been a 16-hour day that had netted very little in terms of evidence that could carry a case toward prosecution. Still, Bosch was satisfied. They had the identification, and that was the center of the wheel. All things would come from that. Edgar said goodnight and went straight to his car without going inside the station. Bosch wanted to check with the watch sergeant to see if anything had come up with Johnny Stokes. He also wanted to check for messages and knew that if he hung around until 11, he might see Julia Brasher when she got off shift. He wanted to talk to her. The station was quiet. The midnight shift cops were up in roll call. The incoming and outgoing watch sergeants would be up there as well. Bosch went down the hallway to the detective bureau. The lights were out, which was in violation of an order from the office of the chief of police. The chief had mandated that the lights in Parker Center and every division station should never be off. His goal was to let the public know that the fight against crime never slept. The result was that the lights glowed brightly every night in empty police offices across the city. Bosch flicked on the row of lights over the homicide table and went to his spot. There were a number of pink phone message slips, and he looked through these, but all were from reporters or related to other cases he had pending. He tossed the reporters' messages in the trash can and put the others in his top drawer to follow up on the next day. There were two department dispatch envelopes waiting on the desk for him. The first contained Gallagher's report, and Bosch put it aside for reading later. He picked up the second envelope and saw it was from Sid. He realized he had forgotten to call Antoine Jesper about the skateboard. He was about to open the envelope when he noticed it had been dropped on top of a folded piece of paper on his calendar blotter. He unfolded it and read the short message. He knew it was from Julia, though she had not signed it.
"Where are you, tough guy?"
He had forgotten that he had told her to come by the squad room before she started her shift. He smiled at the note, but felt bad about forgetting. He also thought once more about Edgar's admonishment to be careful with the relationship. He refolded the page and put it in his drawer. He wondered how Julia would react to what he wanted to talk about. He was dead tired from the long hours, but didn't want to wait until the next day. The dispatch envelope from Sid contained a one-page evidence analysis report from Jesper. Bosch read the report quickly. Jesper had confirmed that the board was made by Boneyard Boards Incorporated, a Huntington Beach manufacturer. The model was called a Boney Board. The particular model at hand was made from February 1978 until June 1986, when design variations created a slight change in the board's nose. Before Bosch could get excited by the implications of a match between the board and the time frame of the case, he read the last paragraph of the report, which put any match in doubt. The trucks, wheel assemblies, are of a design first implemented by Boneyard in May 1984. The graphite wheels also indicate a later manufacture.
Graphite wheels did not become commonplace in the industry until the mid-80s. However, because trucks and wheels are interchangeable and often are traded out or replaced by boarders, it is impossible to determine the exact date of manufacture of the skateboard in evidence. Best estimate pending additional evidence is manufacture between February 1978 and June 1986. Bosch slid the report back into the dispatch envelope and dropped it on the desk. The report was inconclusive, but to Bosch, the factors Jesper had outlined leaned toward the skateboard not having been Arthur Delacroix's. In his mind, the report tilted toward clearing rather than implicating Nicholas Trent in the boy's death. In the morning, he would type up a report with his conclusions and give it to Lieutenant Billets to send up the chain to Deputy Chief Irving's office. As if to punctuate the end of this line of investigation, the sound of the back door to the station banging open echoed down the hallway. Several loud male voices followed, all heading out into the night. Roll call was over and fresh troops were taking the field, their voices full of us-versus-them bravado. The police chief's wishes notwithstanding, Bosch flicked off the light and headed back down the hallway to the watch office. There were two sergeants in the small office. Lenkov was going off duty, while Renshaw was just starting her shift. They both registered surprise at Bosch's appearance so late at night, but then didn't ask him what he was doing in the station. "So," Bosch said, "anything on my guy, Johnny Stokes?" "Nothing yet," Lenkov said. "But we're looking. We're putting it out at all roll calls, and we've got the pictures in the cars now, so you'll let me know." "We'll let you know." Renshaw nodded her agreement. Bosch thought about asking if Julia Brasher had come in to end her shift yet, but thought better of it. He thanked them and stepped back into the hallway. The conversation had felt odd, like they couldn't wait for him to get out of there. He sensed it was because of the word getting around about him and Julia. Maybe they knew she was coming off of shift and wanted to avoid seeing them together. As supervisors, they would then be witnesses to what was an infraction of department policy. As minor and rarely enforced as the rule was, things would be better all the way around if they didn't see the infraction and then have to look the other way. Bosch walked out the back door and into the parking lot. He had no idea whether Julia was in the station locker room, still out on patrol, or had come and gone already. Mid-shifts were fluid. You didn't come in until the watch sergeant sent your replacement out. He found her car in the parking lot and knew he hadn't missed her. He walked back toward the station to sit down on the Code 7 bench, but when he got to it, Julia was already sitting there. Her hair was slightly wet from the locker room shower. She wore faded blue jeans and a long-sleeved pullover with a high neck. "I heard you were in the house," she said. "I checked and saw the light out and thought maybe I'd missed you." "Just don't tell the chief about the lights." She smiled and Bosch sat down next to her. He wanted to touch her, but didn't. "Or us," he said. She nodded. "Yeah. A lot of people know, don't they?" "Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about that. Can you get a drink?"
"Sure.
Let's walk over to the Cat and Fiddle. I'm tired of driving today." Rather than walk through the station together and out the front door, they took the long way through the parking lot and around the station. They walked two blocks up to Sunset and then another two down to the pub. Along the way, Bosch apologized for missing her in the squad room before her shift and explained he had driven to Palm Springs. She was very quiet as they walked, mostly just nodding her head at his explanations. They didn't talk about the issue at hand until they reached the pub and slid into one of the booths by the fireplace. They both ordered pints of Guinness, and then Julia folded her arms on the table and fixed Bosch with a hard stare.
"Okay, Harry, I've got my drink coming. You can give it to me. But I have to warn you, if you're going to say you want to just be friends, well, I already have enough friends."
Bosch couldn't help but break into a broad smile. He loved her boldness, her directness.
He started shaking his head.
Nah, I don't want to be your friend, Julia. Not at all.
He reached across the table and squeezed her forearm. Instinctively, he glanced around the pub to make sure